I thought. What was that about? I woke up on the Sunday and decided I needed to speak to the man myself. I knew from the start that I would eventually have to make this call. It was becoming ridiculous that Tom was forced to be the go-between between my father and me. This was about me, not Tom. And I could see the toll it was taking on my brother, every upsetting interaction being compounded by having to relay it back to me. Tom didn't deserve that pain. I asked Tom for my father's phone number and called him. It went straight to voicemail. Understandable, I thought. He doesn't know my number. I wouldn't pick up a call to my home from a number I didn't recognise. I cleared my throat and wondered if I'd be able to say what I needed to say. The machine beeped. Hello, this is Alan. Cumming. I'm calling to speak to Alec. Cumming. I really need to talk to him about some things that I think he'll know about, and I would really appreciate it if he would call me back as soon as possible. I thought I was about to hang up, but found myself saying more. It's urgent. It's really urgent, so please do call me as soon as you can. Thank you. I recited my number and hung up, and the waiting began. Tom had told me that my father was recuperating from an operation. He was clearly at home. In fact, Tom had spoken to him that morning and told him to expect my call. So as the minutes turned into hours, the fact that he was purposely not calling me back made me more and more angry. Yet again, he had all the power. He couldn't stop himself, I thought. He was so used to keeping me weak, vulnerable, anxious. Though I imagined that part of his failure to speak to me was also due to some trepidation on his part. I wasn't scared of him anymore, and I think that scared him. I called again at 7 p.m. No answer. My father's silence was stopping me from getting out of the hole he had just dug for me. I felt like I was back on the estate again, waiting for him to come and inspect me, but this time I was more angry and frustrated than anxious. I wanted it to be over. I started to think of how I could deal with this situation if he never spoke to me. Grant had told me that I didn't need him to do a DNA test, as men hand down identical Y chromosomes to all their male offspring. Tom and I could do a test, and if Y chromosomes didn't match, that would be proof enough that my father's story was true. So we found the kits on the internet and ordered them to arrive on a night I'd be back in England. Tom would come to my house and we'd take the test. I felt I should wait up until my dad called, but eventually my fatigue won. I was utterly exhausted, but also slightly alarmed that I was going on camera the next morning looking so raddled. There was no makeup or hairdresser available to me for this shoot, no one who could disguise the effects of all I'd learned. This was au naturel, baby, and I cursed myself for not being more demanding. As we climbed up the steps into the sleeping loft, I told Grant that whatever happened, I needed to find out the truth for myself. If my father gave me no more information than what he'd passed on through Tom, I was going to make it my mission to get to the bottom of the story and go and talk to my real father if necessary. Once more, I went to sleep, as I had done so many times as a little boy, with the full knowledge that I could never rely on my father. I was 45 years old. I'd been waiting for a phone call from my father since I was 29, my age the last time we spoke. I guess I should have known what to expect. Monday, the 24th of May, 2010. In the morning, I woke early and got ready. It felt like my first day of school. Despite everything that had happened since I arrived in London, I was actually excited about appearing on Who Do You Think You Are? There was nothing more I could do about the issue of my father, or my real father, at that moment. I decided to focus on diving into the TV show. The fact that my father had backed off from the ongoing investigation into my present almost gave me more breathing space to look forward and, dare I say it, enjoy the experience I was about to undergo from the past. My progeny issue was on hold, certainly until the DNA test kit arrived and was completed, and I was ready to fully commit to Who Do You Think You Are? And the reason I had agreed to the show in the first place, to solve the mystery of my maternal grandfather, Tommy Darling. As I rang for the elevator to take me down to the streets of Soho, my phone rang. It was him. Hello there, this is Alec Cumming. At first I didn't recognise his voice. There was kindness in it. And of course he didn't say, it's your dad, so I was thrown all the more. I'd started my day determined to take control of my feelings and my situation. Now, I panicked. The bell of the elevator pinged to signal its arrival. My phone would lose signal when I stepped in. He went on, "I'm sorry I missed your calls yesterday. I can't speak to you now," came from somewhere inside me. "I have to go to work." There was a pause. "Well, don't worry about it. We'll get this sorted out." Who was this person? He sounded concerned. I suddenly remembered reading in one of the hundreds of emails sent to me with the details of my week that I would be done by 5 p.m. this afternoon. "I'll call you back at 5 o'clock, I said firmly. I couldn't believe how calm and forceful I was being. "Okay, 5 o'clock. I'll talk to you then, Alan." I hung up and the elevator door opened and I stepped in. My legs buckled from under me, my stomach churned and I burst into tears. I longed for that elevator to break down, to trap me there, to give me time to recover and regroup. Aside from hello and take care at my granny's funeral, those were the first words I'd spoken to my father in over 16 years. I spent the next few hours being filmed wandering around Covent Garden watching the street entertainers. This material would be used for the beginning of my episode of Who Do You Think You Are, with the sonorous voiceover setting the scene for my story. It was a sunny day, and I looked like I didn't have a care in the world. "Nobody knows," I thought, as I watched a sinewy, topless man do a handstand walk over a line of hapless, prone tourists. "Nobody knows." I was just so relieved to have a break from the constant buzz in my head that had started 3 days ago. Now I had new things to think about, new people to meet. I've never been one of those performers who purports to believe that acting is a welcome refuge, something to deflect or cover up things they can't or don't want to deal with in their real lives. I just like acting. That's why I do it. But that day, I completely used acting to push away my present, to gain some respite from the chaos, and yes, the fear I knew I'd immediately drop back into when my attention was no longer diverted. It was just that today, the part I was acting was myself, or this casual celebrity strolling around pretending not to notice the cameras. We went to an apartment nearby to do an establishing interview about my reasons for doing the show and what I hoped to find out. "I sort of pride myself on being connected to my Scottish heritage," I began. "But in more specific ways, I realise that I don't really know much about my family beyond the ones that are alive." Every word I spoke seemed to me dripping with irony. And it got worse. "You base who you are on your immediate lineage, and so if there are gaps in that, and mysteries in that, there are mysteries in you." I switched the focus back on the direction the show was going to take, the investigation of Thomas Darling. "And my mum's dad is the family mystery. He's the black hole. There's a picture of him on my hallway wall, and each time I go past him, it's a big zero. I know nothing." It was true. Tommy Darling to me was just a face, a handsome face in an open-neck shirt with a strip of military honours just above his chest, a little black moustache. His expression was blank. I didn't yet know that this picture was taken only a few months before he died. "He didn't come back after the war, and he never came home," I went on. "He died in a shooting accident, but at my granny's funeral, someone sort of intimated to me that it wasn't an accident." This, I think, had been the inadvertent catalyst to my taking on this whole odyssey and agreeing to do this show. At Granny's funeral just 5 years prior, my main preoccupation had been to make sure my mum was doing okay. My other preoccupation, sadly, had been to keep away from my father's partner, who, earlier in an act that redefined inappropriateness, had blurted out that she needed to get my autograph for her granddaughter as she shook my hand in the crematorium receiving line mere minutes after we'd sent my granny's coffin into the flames. I was literally struck dumb. Next to me, I actually could feel the ire exuding from my brother's body and quickly placed a hand on his forearm to calm him. I hoped that my mother, just a couple of feet away, had not heard. In a way, perhaps, the woman did me a favour. Because she had so appalled me, I was jolted out of the agitation I'd been feeling as my father appeared, next in the line of people passing by. "Hello." I nodded curtly and looked past him to the next mourner in line. Later, as we raised a glass to Granny at a hotel in Inverness, I caught the woman's eye across the room and could see she had not been shamed, but fully intended to pursue her goal. She made to approach me. I gave her a look that I hoped made clear my utter lack of willingness. It was the visual equivalent of, back off, bitch. Hell no. I was not to be trifled with. Not at my granny's funeral. And not by this woman. I talked to as many of granny's old friends as possible. In one corner were a few older men, all of whom had known her for decades. We got chatting about old times. They wondered if I remembered Sam, her second husband. I said I didn't, though I loved the fact that she used to come and visit us when I was a little boy on the back of his motorbike. It was one of those memories that I had no true visual of, but a very vibrant, manufactured one in my mind. It was so granny. "Did you know Tommy Darling?" I asked one of the men.
"Oh, aye," he replied. "I knew him fine."
"He never came back after the war, did he?" I said. The man really looked at me. Something cleared behind his rheumy eyes. "No," he said enigmatically. "And he died in a shooting accident?" I fished.
"Well, they called it an accident,"
came the reply. "You don't think it was?" I tried to not sound too shocked. Suddenly, a hand was on my shoulder and a departing cousin took my attention. It wasn't till much later that night that I recalled this man's remark at all. Back in Covent Garden, we were wrapping up the interview. I sometimes feel that other parts of my life have been like an episode of Dallas, so I don't know why this shouldn't be too, I joked for the camera. But it was also true. Some of the details of my family's dystopian past were much more in step with the plot lines of a histrionic television show than an everyday tale of country folk. For example, the husband of the woman who was chasing me around my grandmother's wake for an autograph had taken his own life when she told him she was leaving him for my father. Oh yes, and his son was in my father's employ at the time. And the doctor who was called to identify the body and sign the death certificate became, a few years later, my brother-in-law, when he married my ex-wife's sister. Thank you, cut to commercial break. I'm 45, you know. Time's marching on. I just think you do become more curious about the past and... you want to know.
God, yes, you do, Alan. Yes, you do.
Elizabeth, the director, then steered me towards the first port of call in my quest. The next day, I would be in Mary Darling's front room, asking my mother questions about who her father was. I was told that we were leaving immediately for the train station. I thought we were staying that evening in London, but the early finish was in fact to facilitate travel. At 5 p.m. that afternoon, I would not be sitting comfortably in the privacy of my own flat dialing my father's number, but on a train, zooming north through the English countryside towards Scotland. Then. Train stations will forever mean granny for me. When she came to visit us, my mum and I would go to Arbroath to collect her from the train station. I can still feel the excitement building in my tummy as we waited for her to appear amid the throngs. Finally, I'd spot her, and as soon as she caught my eye, her little face would burst into a grin, her suitcases would drop to her sides, and her arms would fling open to greet me as I sped down the platform towards her like a bolt of lightning. I loved my granny. I think she was the first person to let me know it was okay to be different. The crafts I made at school that my father scoffed at and I was afraid to show him were not only praised by granny, but hung up on her wall. After she died, my mum sent me a cross-stitch sampler I'd made in primary school for her birthday. I laughed when I saw it, all those years later. The wrong stitches, the size of my name dwarfing hers, but Granny had greeted it as though it were the most magical work of art. When we went to stay in her little flat in Inverness, she'd let Tom and me lie in bed with her, read comics and eat sweets. Indeed, Granny not only encouraged us to bend the rules, she was usually the instigator. She was the one who'd first pulled us into the middle of the Grant Street pedestrian suspension bridge in Inverness and started jumping up and down to make the whole thing wobble, sending us into giggles and screams in equal measure. Of course, after that, we did this every time we crossed. When I was a little older, maybe 11 or so, and staying with her on my own for a weekend, she took me to the cinema. The only movies playing were X-rated, but that did not deter my granny. Somehow or other, I was smuggled into the theatre for a David Essex double feature of That'll Be the Day and Stardust. David Essex was a huge UK pop and movie star at this time, and I felt so incredibly sophisticated getting to see him in action, in an X-rated film, no less. I remember vividly a scene in which he is being pressured by his manager to write more songs for his album, and he says the immortal line, "I'm an artist, not a machine." Granny and I thought this was hilarious and repeated it all weekend long, and indeed, I still use it today. Talking of hilarious, that was her favourite and most used word. Except in her Highland accent, she pronounced it hilarious, which somehow made it even more, well, hilarious. As I got older, I had to work every school holidays, and so my visits to see her in Inverness became fewer and far between. When Granny came to visit us, the atmosphere in the house changed. Her spirit infected everyone. My father was in better spirits, and we felt safer when she was near. Even if she was there when I had to work all day, it still felt like a holiday knowing she would be at home when I returned from the forest or as I sped down the sawmill yard for lunch. But gradually, my father's behaviour became more obvious to Granny, especially when he would disappear out every night, even when she was staying. I could see the concern on her face as she glanced at her daughter when my dad popped into the living room for his "That's me away." I never heard Granny say a bad word about my father, but I know she was incredibly supportive of my mum leaving him. She always wished the best for everyone. I think I've inherited some of her mischief and joie de vivre, and I hope her compassion. The last time I saw her was just after she'd had a heart attack and wasn't well enough to make her eldest son Tommy's 60th birthday celebrations, so we all gathered at her little assisted living house before the party. She was very frail and looked a little overwhelmed at having so many people in her home, but she was still the same old Granny. I had cropped blonde hair at the time, maybe for a film role, but maybe because it just took my fancy. And it was the cause of much scoffing by some family members. "What's this, another weird haircut, Alan?" said one. "Well, I like it," Granny's frail little voice piped up from deep in the chair she was sunk into. "And if I was young again, I'd have my hair a different colour every week. I'd be a freak like Alan too." The day after her funeral, I had a sudden desire to go to the Grant Street suspension bridge and say my own goodbye to her. Funerals sometimes are to be endured, and as I've said, my main concern that day was looking after Mum. As Grant and I walked across, my heart sank. I was jumping up and down, but it didn't feel nearly as bouncy and magical as it had all those years ago. But when we got to the middle, it was completely as scary and fun as I'd remembered, and we both leapt up and down like five-year-olds. "Goodbye, Granny," I shouted out to the sky. "I love you. Thank you." Grant was taking pictures and laughing with me. We stopped bouncing and had a hug. I felt really close to Granny in that moment and was so happy Grant was there to experience it. They had never met, but I knew they would have loved each other. Still giddy, we began to race back to the car like schoolboys in the playground. As Grant tried to pass me, I put out my arm to stop him, and suddenly his camera flew out of his hand, up, up into the sky. It banged against one suspension wire with a huge metallic clang, then another, before plunging into the freezing waters of the River Ness below. We both stopped in our tracks, utterly shocked. "That was weird," said Grant. "That was Granny," I replied, quite certain. I'm not religious in the slightest, but I do truly believe that people's energies can be present or invoked after they're gone. It was as if she wanted to be part of the fun on that bridge too. And losing the camera was her way of telling us to use our imaginations more, enjoy our memories, but live in the moment. At least that's what I've chosen to think. And whatever happened, I certainly had that moment of connection I'd craved with Granny. Monday, May the 24th, 2010, late afternoon. Outside the window, England slid by in a bucolic blur. I took deep breaths. I cleared my throat, laid out my pad and pen. This wasn't going to be easy. I needed to be strong. I had nothing to be ashamed of. I remembered the wise words of an American president that so connected with me, I had them written in neon on the kitchen wall of my London flat. "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." I knew an awful lot about fear. I waited till 5 o'clock and pressed call. He answered after a few rings. "Hello?" His voice. Fainter than I remembered, but with the same Highland upward inflection as always. "Hi, it's Alan." "Uh-huh. How are you doing?" he asked. "Well, Obviously, I'm not doing so great.
Don't get riled.
I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask you, and so I'd just like to get started. I was being blunt on purpose, keeping him at bay, not allowing him to derail or entangle me.
All right. I've had that reporter fellow down here again,
he said, doing exactly that. Okay, I'll talk about that later, but do you think we could stick to the issue of me not being your son for now?
Don't mess with me, old man.
Aye. I know you must have a lot of questions. I looked down at my notes. I'd made a list with careful spaces for me to scribble down his answers. I needed to remember every second of this conversation. Are you certain? Are you absolutely certain? I tried to sound flat and scientific.
I'd never have brought it up if I wasn't certain, Alan, said my father. I wrote you a letter about it, years ago. It's in my will. But when I heard you were doing this TV program, I didn't want you to find out that way, so that's why I called Tom.
The next question was difficult to ask. I was born on January the 27th, 1965, and I needed the math to make sense. I needed it all to make sense, and so I said it. So you're certain you didn't have sex with Mum at any time during the months of April or May of 1964?
No, Alan, no. Sex had been sporadic with your mother for some time before that.
Okay, that was definitely more than I wanted to know.
A simple no would have sufficed, but I chose to be encouraged by his openness instead.
It's why we had to move away from Dunkeld, Alan, my father proffered.
Why?
The shame, he said. There it was. I knew it would rear its ugly head before too long.
The shame of Mum having sex with someone else, I asked, wondering if, like me, he'd imagined how this conversation would pan out, and if he thought we'd go this deep so soon.
The shame of people knowing, he sidestepped slightly.
I was compromised in my work because I had dealings with him.
That made sense. We moved away from Dunkeld to the west coast of Scotland, near Fort William, when I was just under a year old, and stayed there till I was four when we moved to Panmure Estate. And I remembered enough from growing up to understand how a small rural community like Dunkeld could be unbearable when everyone knew your dirty laundry. This also made some sense of my father so blatantly flaunting his mistresses as we were growing up. Did he want my mother to feel that same pain, that shame, that slight on his manhood that he'd carried all through the first year of my life? Pain that hurt so badly he moved his young family across a country to forge a new life away from it. Does my real father know? I moved on.
Oh yes, he knows. He must know. You see, he and his wife had a child, I think a son, shortly after you were born.
Wait, what? I hadn't really thought through the new siblings issue. I mean, I suppose I presume my real father had other children, but a half-brother of my own age was something else. His wife was pregnant at the same time as Mum was, I asked.
Yes, he had a couple of other kids too, but she divorced him. And then, well,
his voice trailed off to nothing.
What?
I wish he'd just tell me. Every pause felt like a booby trap. I couldn't trust him.
Well, then he tried to shoot himself, said my father.
So yet another man had encountered the morass of my family and felt the only solution was to put a gun to his head. This did not bode well. This was an episode of Dallas.
But he lived? I managed to get out finally.
Oh yes. He missed. His family took him away. He's fine now.
Did he remarry? I wondered.
The cast of my life's new characters was mushrooming.
He has a partner. I don't know if they ever married, he replied.
I looked down at my list of questions. We were moving through them swiftly, a little too swiftly, perhaps. Suddenly emotion reared its head for a second and I had to gulp it back down. I hesitated.
Sorry, it's just a lot to take in, I said, recovering.
And in that moment, that split second of contemplation, my father pounced.
I can imagine, he said coolly. I've had those reporter fellows at my door a few times saying things that were a shock to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were discussing the fact that I've believed for 45 years that you were my father when you're not. I didn't know we were back to talking about you and how maligned you've been by the tabloids. Sorry.
His narcissism knew no bounds.
I said, you know, I'm really sorry you've had to deal with stuff like that. but I think if you knew me better, or at all, if you even knew how to contact me, you could have called me up and I'd have told you how to deal with them. And I could have told you that what they were saying wasn't true. I didn't want to get sidetracked. I still had so much more to ask. But it was as if my father hadn't heard me.
I've had them outside my door several times over the years. Always asking for my comment about something you've said, he continued.
You know what, Dad? I called him Dad for the first time. It was a mistake. I'd purposely refrained up till now, but it just popped out. It made me feel weak and a little boy again. I understand. I really do. I deal with the press every single day of my life. All I'm saying is the fact that I'm not in your life is not only the reason they're there in the first place, but also why you don't know how to deal with them.
They rang my doorbell and asked me to comment.
He wasn't listening. I had to take it up a notch. Listen to me. This is not what we're talking about today. But I want you to know that I have always told the truth to the press. Sometimes the truth hurts and sometimes the truth is manipulated and distorted by them, but I have never said anything to them with the intention of hurting you. I paused. There was silence on the line. I took the initiative. I could see that I had a limited amount of time before my father would be of no help to me. I was that little boy back on the estate again, weighing up whether there was a chance I could talk him down or if it was only a matter of time till I get hit. Only today, he wouldn't hit me. Just withhold what he knew I needed right now more than anything in the world. The truth. He had all the power, just the way he liked it. I looked down at the next question on my list and said, "Who else knows?" He named an old friend of my mum's who he thought had been told, though he couldn't be certain. His sister had broached the subject before she died. And of course, the woman he now lived with, she of the suicide husband and the autograph-hunting granddaughter. And also my real father's wife, of course. He said he had run into her from time to time over the years, and although he could tell she knew, they had never discussed it. Was Mum having an affair with him for a long time? I hoped she had been. She deserved to have enjoyed loving attention, and I hoped she had it. But if my existence was due to just one brief moment of tenderness, then that was okay too.
Well, I do remember not long before all this I was asked to start taking Tommy to football practice on Saturday afternoons.
There was anger in his tone for the first time. And what, you think she was seeing him on those afternoons? I prodded.
I couldn't say for sure.
But you think so?
Yes. I have a pretty good idea.
Again, we went over the story of that night. The dance at the Burnham Hotel in Dunkeld. Mum was gone for a while when the man's wife came over and said her husband was nowhere to be seen either. They set off together through the crowded dance floor looking, and then back through the bar and into the hotel itself. As they climbed the stairs, a door opened, and my mum appeared, the man behind her. They stood looking at each other for a moment, and then he grabbed my mother's wrist and said,
"There's no point in staying here any longer,"
and yanked her away. "And you never talked about it again, ever?" I asked.
"Well, once. Years later at Panmure, it nearly came up."
My father paused, reliving the moment, and then, as though he had never considered it in the intervening decades, said,
"It was on your birthday, funnily enough."
I sat, stunned, into silence. I looked out the window. We were coming into one of those northern towns. Lancaster, was it? Or York? Yes, York, probably.
"You must have known, Alan."
"What?" For a moment, the train stopped. Everything stopped.
"Come on, you must have known."
He was almost jovial, like we had jumped to the "we can laugh about it now" stage of this story. We had not. I was dumbfounded. How could I possibly have known? My father cleared his throat and paused for effect.
"Did you not notice we never bonded?" he said.
It was as though he was explaining the solution of a puzzle to me. I spluttered. Again he spoke.
"Did you ever wonder why we never bonded?"
Now everything sped up. A series of nanosecond memories from years ago bombarded my vision. My father's furious and demented face, the stinging his hands left on me, the humiliation, the despair. I wanted to scream out that yes, I had indeed wondered why we never bonded. But him not being my biological father was not the reason why. But I couldn't. I was, quite literally, stunned. The train was moving. My heart was beating. My father was waiting for a response on the end of the line. I felt I was out of my depth in dealing with this man. And then I got it. He was asking me to accept that his behavior to me was justified because I was not his blood. He wanted me to condone my own physical and mental abuse. Of course, I noticed we never bonded, I managed to say. But I didn't know why. I thought you were just an angry, unhappy man, I added softly. Why didn't you divorce Mum? I asked quickly. I felt like the elevator doors had begun to close and I was grabbing my last chances before this conversation dissolved completely. I couldn't do that, he countered impatiently. I had kids to bring up.
Yes, I know. I was one of them.
We'd been talking for a while, and I'd asked all my questions. I didn't know quite how you wound up a conversation like this, but I knew for sure that my father was not going to be the one to do it. And I was done.
You know, I began,
when I think of your relationship, you were the one who always had the affairs, and so openly, and I always wondered why Mum didn't complain more about that. Is it because she felt she couldn't really complain because she had had the first affair, which had ended your marriage? There was a heavy pause. I thought I'd gone too far.
Well, I can't speak for your mother, he said, finally. But sometimes people stay together for the kids. They make sacrifices for them. And your mother and I waited till you were both out of the house before we separated.
Oh, boy, here we go. The old we stayed together for you kids routine. So not only was I, through my newfound half-breed status, responsible for my own abuse, but the fact that this abuse lasted for so many years was due to the kindness and self-sacrifice of my abuser. Great! My whole body felt on the brink of explosion or collapse or combustion. I'd one last question.
So my real father, where is he living now? I asked.
It was as though I had pressed an ignition button. My father was suddenly years younger and snarled with the power and fury of the man that haunted me.
Don't you go bothering him!
I was jolted back in my seat. I knew I had to keep calm, that the man who was shouting at me was not rational, and his default method of communication was shouting. I mustn't give him the excuse to feel I'd attacked him.
I'm not going to bother him.
But I've only discovered 3 days ago that he is my father, so I think I have the right to ask a few questions about him, don't you?
Silence.
Don't you, Dad?
He ignored my question, but told me a few details about where this man now lived.
My father thought he ran a pub or a garage. I wondered if I'd ever meet him, or my half-siblings. I wondered what they'd be like. I told my father I was going ahead with the DNA test.
I'm not sending a swab to America, came the retort.
He was angry now. Well, you don't need to. I explained how Tom and I would do the test ourselves. I would be in touch when I had the results. I could tell the wind had been blown out of his sails. Withholding his DNA was his last trump card. Now he was the one who would have to wait. I put the phone down next to my pad and pen, then clasped my hands together and allowed my body to shake. My teeth began to chatter. My watch battered against the table's surface. My knees jerked involuntarily. Sunny England sped by. I pulled myself together and walked back the few carriages to join the BBC crew. Then. It was between Christmas and New Year, and everything was quiet and everything was white. We'd had an unusually large snowfall, which made me happy. The snow meant that everything calmed down. My father's attention was diverted away from the ordinary, from me, to the effects of the snow and the conditions of local roads. The estate workers were given days off until the snow cleared, and the normal schedule of jobs I had to do was postponed, aside from shoveling and bringing in logs. It was actually permissible to do a bit of lolling. I loved the sound of the snow. It was calm and echoey at the same time, and the world felt a safer place being insulated by it. My mum and I were watching TV. Suddenly, the front door was thrown open and my father's voice began roaring for my mother. Mum and I both leapt up, terrified. It sounded like he was injured or being chased. She reached the living room door before me, but I managed to catch a glimpse of my father, staggering slightly as he made for the front room, the posh one we never used except for when visitors came, around Christmas. Behind him, I saw Mr. Shaw, the head gamekeeper, with whom my dad had obviously been drinking. My father wasn't a drunk by any means. Like most Scotsmen, he liked to drink. but I rarely saw him in a state beyond what would be called a bit merry, so seeing him like this now was quite shocking. I blamed Mr. Shaw and the snow. The former was known to like a drink a little too much, and the latter allowed a situation where boredom and close proximity to a drinks cabinet might lead to the current situation.
"We want whiskey, woman!"
my father roared as he sped by. My mother closed the door, leaving me in the living room, wondering what the outcome of their muffled yet heated tones would be. A few minutes later, my mother rushed back into the room and made for the kitchen. "The cheek of the man," she said over her shoulder, and then re-emerged with a jug of water, presumably destined to be mixed with whiskey in the front room. "Coming in here and shouting at me like that." Just then Tom arrived home. He asked me what had happened and I told him. "Dad's drunk."
"Drunk?"
said Tom. "In the afternoon. He's been at Mr. Shaw's house and now they've come here because they ran out of whiskey." Suddenly the voices from the other end of the house grew louder and the front door opened and closed. I waited for the usual ensuing draft of cold air to slide through to us under the living room door. Mr. Shaw must have gone home. Now the voices of my parents rose to a crescendo, and they both entered the living room, my mother enraged at the behaviour of her husband, my father bleary and bloody and bemused.
"Get upstairs, boys," he slurred.
"What makes you think you can come in about here and shout at me like that, asking for whiskey like I'm your servant?" I heard my mum say, strong and indignant, as the kitchen door closed on us.
"I'll come in here whatever way I want to," began my father. "This is my house."
Tom raced me up the stairs, and won, as usual. The big room where we went to do our homework and to play games was freezing. We tried to occupy our time reading and messing about, but we were both silently agitated about what was going on downstairs. It was unusual for Mum to be so feisty. It signalled something changing in her, and her attitude towards our father, and although it made me nervous, I liked it. She had recently started working in the office of a grain mill in the local village. She was finding herself again. Initially, my father was very against her taking the job. For several years previously, she had been taking night classes at Tom's high school to gain qualifications that would enable her to return to the workforce. This had not sat well with my father either, who constantly made attempts to sabotage or undermine her progress. The most glaring and brutal example of this was one spring evening when my father had ordered Tom and me to accompany him out to the field below our house and help him catch one of our sheep that was about to lamb. As was usual on these sorts of occasions, our father would tell us to stand behind a hedgerow and then chase the stressed ewe towards us, screaming obscenities if we failed to grab its horns and wrestle it to the ground as it ran past us in fear of its life. He treated us basically as sheepdogs, often even whistling commands and expecting us to understand what he meant. That particular night, we eventually caught the poor sheep, and were just about to close the pen to give it some peace, when our mother appeared at the top of the field, dressed for our night class. "That's me away," she called out, and swiftly turned on her heels to go back through the garden gates and into her car. I could sense my father's mood shifting, seeing her like this, and it came as no surprise when I heard him yell out to my mother's back,
"Get down here! We need a hand!"
"I have my glasses, Ali," she half stated, half pleaded.
"This animal is in distress. Get down here."
It struck me that any stress was probably due to the fact that the sheep was heavily pregnant and we had just been making it run madly around the field for the past half an hour. I could tell that all it needed was to relax, lie down and continue its labour. Our mother arrived at the pen, navigating the mud and mounds of sheep feces. "I'll be late, Ali," she implored. My father ignored her and turned towards us and the poor sheep.
"Get in here and help us hold down this beast," he said calmly and scarily.
Tom and I looked at Mum and wondered what she'd do. What could she do? She put down her folders and notebooks and climbed over the gate to join us. Our father made us hold down the sheep and commanded my mother to help it give birth. This meant she had to put her arm up its uterus and pull out the baby lamb. This is not an uncommon practice in the country. Often it came to me to do this because I had the smallest hands. But this time we all knew it wasn't necessary at all.
"You better get going then,"
my father taunted her when she eventually stood up, her face speckled, her good blouse drenched in blood. But Mum persevered, and when the job came up in the granary's office, she somehow managed to persuade my father that it would not interfere with his household requirements. Indeed, I offered to help even more with getting the tea ready each night, helping ensure that my father's regulated existence would not be disrupted. I could feel that this job was the start of something new and good. "Boys, tea's ready." Tom and I looked at each other. We both wondered what was waiting for us downstairs. Mum sounded fine, in control even. But where was our father? We had heard no door slamming to signal he had gone out, so he must still be in the kitchen, and after the shouting match we had heard earlier, what dark mood would radiate from him now? We entered the kitchen and both stopped in our tracks. My father was seated at his usual place, next to me, at the kitchen table, but he was leaning forward, head and arms sprawled across the tabletop. He was out cold, and my mother had set the table for our evening meal around him. "Come on, it's all right. He won't wake up," said Mum, sensing my anxiety. It felt like I was going into the sleeping ogre's den. Tom laughed. "Are we going to eat our tea with him just lying there?" he asked. "Yes," said Mum calmly. "Your father doesn't seem to be hungry, but we all need to eat." So we sat down and awkwardly passed the butter and condiments over my father as we ate our food. Once I looked up and saw that his eyes had opened and were staring right at me. Immediately panic seized me, but he merely swallowed, smacked his lips, and closed his eyes again. After a while, I began to enjoy this Alice in Wonderland-like experience. We all did. In his drunkenness, our father was no threat to us, and more than that, he was no impediment to the continuation of our daily routine. Sitting at that table night after night was terrifying. It would be again tomorrow, no doubt, but tonight, with my father snoring and us passing the biscuit plate over his head, we could breathe easy. Later, when we'd washed the dishes and removed the table things from around him, my mother suggested we drive to Dundee to see the new film everyone had been talking about, Jaws. I couldn't believe my ears. I could count the number of times we'd gone to the cinema as a family, or at least a part family, on the fingers of one hand. I ran upstairs to get changed in a state of ecstasy. Everything was changing this night. The idea that we would be going off to do something as luxurious and rare as driving all the way to Dundee in the snow to see a movie was exciting enough. But to do so as our father lay snoring in the darkness of the kitchen unaware was simply beautiful. And that my mother was so calm and sure in her actions made it all the more sweet. Tom asked if he could cycle to Manicki to see his girlfriend instead of coming with us. Mum agreed. It seemed anything was possible tonight. We set off in the car, and after we'd wound along the crispy, moonlit country roads for a few minutes, Mum spoke up. "Alan, what would you think about you and me and Tommy living on our own?" I felt as if the heavens had opened, and there was light and warmth and goodness pouring into the car. I felt God. It was almost too much. This afternoon, everything had been normal. The snow had allowed some brief respite, but now it was as if the whole world had changed. I wanted to cry, I wanted to laugh, I wanted to leap across the seat and shower my mother with kisses. But I was paralysed. My mouth was dry and I could barely hear myself say, "Away from Dad, you mean?" I just wanted to be sure. "Yes, away from Dad. Just you and me and Tommy living together. Would you like that?" "Yes," I said, a tear plopping down my cheek. "I would like that." Suddenly, the car hit a patch of ice, and we were spinning madly out of control. Forever, it seemed. I thought we were both going to die. The God I had glimpsed moments ago turned out to be not so benevolent. He was the same old God, the one that quashed your dreams and kept you in line. He was the angry, vengeful man of a God, and my mum had dared to cross him. By the time the car had stopped, we were facing the way we had come, and my side of the car was leaning into a ditch. The engine was off, and I could only hear our panicked breathing and my heart beating wildly in my little bony chest. After a few moments, Mum asked if I was okay, and I whispered that I was. She started the engine, and we went on our way again, but quietly and meekly now, all triumph and elation gone. The matter was never spoken of again. Years later at drama school, I learned of the Moiré, the goddesses who controlled everyone's fate, and the dangers of crossing them by trying to step away from the destined path we are given. We called them Moira instead of Moiré. And our history of drama teacher indulged us, hoping, I suppose, that humour would better aid our memories come exam time.
"Coming," he said, one rainy Glasgow afternoon. "Do you understand this concept? Do you know what it feels like to overstep your Moira?"
At once I was back in that car on that icy road, spinning to potential death, just seconds from having heard the offer of freedom.
"Oh yes," I replied. "I understand."
Tuesday, the 25th of May, 2010. By 6 a.m, I was staring out my hotel room window at the old Dundee docks. I was so tired, but my mind wouldn't let me sleep. In a few short hours, I would see my mother. I was worried she'd sense something was wrong. I felt as though there was a sign above my head declaring, "Man in trouble." I had so many questions that I wanted to yet couldn't ask, and certainly not in front of a TV crew. And after all, today's discoveries and revelations were not going to be about me or my real father. I had to try and put everything about that to one side and appear my normal self. I had to act. No matter what is going on in my real life, I know how to block it out when I'm working. Whether I've had good news, bad news, I'm feeling hungover, joyful, sick, it's all part of the job description of an actor to know how to neutralise it all and become whatever the character needs to feel. Today was no different. I would become what the audience would expect. Cheeky chappy Alan Cumming having tea with his mum and looking through old family photos and mementos. It shouldn't require much of me. Yet looking out at the water as the sun began to slowly slide along its surface, I didn't know if I was up to it. I went to the gym and hoped the endorphins would cancel out the buzzing in my head for a while. I met the crew for breakfast and pretty soon we were off, filming in the car as I drove along the coast road toward my mum's. I talked to my mum as I drove, captured by the camera being pointed at me from the passenger seat. I spoke of how much I admire her, how she has rolled with the punches through the changes in my life, and how much she has grown as a person over the years. I also spoke of how she still has the ability to surprise me. Considering the events of the past few days, that was an understatement. When we arrived at Mary Darling's house, Elizabeth, the director, and the sound man hurried over to put a microphone on her, and also shield her from seeing me so that our reunion on camera would be utterly spontaneous. I could see my mum trying to peep over their shoulders to see me. She was brimming with excitement, I could tell. I bet she hadn't slept much the night before either, albeit for different reasons. Soon, after we'd hugged on her doorstep, we went into our living room and began to set up what would be the major part of the discussion. Just what my mum knew about her father. As the crew set up some lights, and Mum and Elizabeth conferred about what she was going to say and show me, I began to scour the walls and shelves of her lounge for all the pictures of my family. There we were, Tom and me as kids, in our swimming trunks in the garden at Panmure, on a jetty after a boat trip. Then later, college, weddings, holidays. My father was nowhere to be seen, of course. My mother left him when I was 20 and away at drama school in Glasgow. She'd worked hard to be financially independent of him, and then, just when I thought they had reached an amiable situation of leading entirely separate lives under the same roof, she called me up and announced she would be living at a different address from then on. For so many years I'd longed for my parents to separate, but when I heard the news, I was sideswiped, stunned, and strangely upset. It was as though all the pent-up sadness of watching two people in such an unhappy union came flooding out of me. I hadn't realised just how much I wanted their relationship to work, I guess. I longed for a proper mum and dad with a normal relationship, and now it was clear that this would never happen. Looking around at these images spanning my entire life, it was not difficult to believe that I had a different father. A weird calm descended upon me, and I just knew. "So, Mum, what do you remember of your father?" I asked her. She was a little nervous and very cautious as she spoke. It made me love her even more. She spoke of how little she knew of the man, just that he had been in the military, a Cameron Highlander. He was stationed in Inverness, where he met my granny. Tommy Darling was 20 in 1937 when he married. Mary Darling was born a year later, and her three brothers followed in quick succession. But despite having a growing family, Tommy Darling's visits home grew less and less frequent. In the talks we'd had about him in the months preceding, I'd asked my mother why she thought he had come back home so little, and she said that it was common during the war for a soldier's leave to be cancelled or postponed. That made sense, I suppose, but surely a gap of 5 years was a little extreme. I asked Mum where her father had gone after the war. Well, he went to several places. He was in France and Burma, she replied. What did he do? I asked. I didn't even know this most basic piece of information about him. He was a biker, a courier who carried information amongst battalions on the battlefield. Mum then showed me a pewter mug that he had. It was one of the few things she owned that had belonged to Tommy Darling. According to the inscription, he'd won the cup at a services motorbike trial in 1939. So he's a biker, I joked. A picture of Tommy Darling was beginning to form in my mind, and he was certainly challenging my preconceptions. She also had his certificate of service, and I read it aloud. An excellent type. Honest, sober. I looked up at Mum. That's unusual for our family. I beg your pardon, she quipped right back. Mum then very proudly showed me a medal he had received for bravery in the field. I'd seen it as a child, but knew nothing about when or why Tommy Darling had been recognised in this way. We talked about the circumstances of his death. In 1950, he had taken a job with the Malayan police force, and less than a year later, he was dead. Mary Darling was 13, and she had not seen her father since she was 8. When I gently asked her the circumstances of his death, my mother quietly described the story as it had been shared with her. He had been cleaning a gun. There was still a bullet in the chamber. He had shot himself accidentally. This was news to me. I had always remembered he had been shot accidentally on a shooting range, a stray bullet making him a victim of that particularly oxymoronic phrase, friendly fire. I suppose my boyish imagination must have just made that up. The plot was definitely thickening. As the interview wound up, I smiled at her and gave her a kiss. I knew Mum had been anxious, but she had done a really good job. Now, as she scampered through to the kitchen to begin serving the lunch she'd prepared for me and the crew, I took a moment to reflect on how similar our situations were right now. Both of us on the brink of finding out the truth about our fathers. I had a flash of having to tell her what my father had revealed, and how her face would crumble as I did so. But I put that thought away for now. Alan, will you pour these people a glass of wine instead of just sitting there? My mum admonished me. My reverie was broken and I snapped back into my role as dutiful son. The next step in my investigation was to delve further into Tommy Darling's military life. And so just a couple of hours later, I was at the National Library of Scotland, a beautiful building just off the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. I'd actually filmed there the year before, for a documentary I'd made about the Scottish sense of humour, and had been very happy to discover via one of its ancient tomes that we Scots were the first to ever catalogue the word fuck. Now here I was again, with Tommy Darling's military records and documents spread out in front of me, poring over them with a military historian. The first thing that struck me was why my grandfather had chosen to join the Cameron Highlanders and not a battalion closer to his home. I learned that the Highlanders had a great reputation for being a very loyal, closely knit group of soldiers. Thinking back to the fact that my granddad had been an orphan, I thought perhaps he was looking for a family in the military. A lump formed at the back of my throat. Wow, this was going to be harder than I thought. Pouring my attention into discovering the life of my grandfather as a way of temporarily avoiding my own past was not going to work. Especially if everything I learned I could relate to how I was feeling and my experiences. I also began to see why perhaps my grandfather was such an absent father. His experience of family was so limited, maybe it was something he could never quite understand. Tommy Darling was stationed in Inverness and worked as a cook in the barracks there. His military records painted the picture of a model soldier. Indeed, the only negative in any of his records from this time was that one night he'd been stopped by a military policeman and fined for riding his motorbike with insufficient light on his registration plate. I looked at the wedding photographs of Tommy Darling and my granny, recognising my great Auntie Ina as a bridesmaid, and began to build a picture of the young, newly married cook, soon to be a father for the first time, full of hope for the future, building the family he never had. Then, suddenly, everything changed. In 1939, war broke out, and Tommy Darling extended his time in the army and volunteered as a dispatch rider for the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. Suddenly I remembered the initials RAOC that were on that pewter mug. I showed it to the historian, who examined it and told me that Tommy Darling had been given that mug for winning a trial or a test of a motorcyclist's ability to travel cross-country under the kind of conditions that would exist in war. And pretty soon, he would be experiencing war for real, as in 1940, the Cameron Highlanders were shipped off to France and into the front lines of World War II. As I looked through photographs and accounts of the Allied efforts, I learned exactly what a dispatch rider would actually have done in battle. I also began to see that Tommy Darling was a bit of a daredevil. In the space of a few hours, I had found out that